Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 aboard the Nebuchadnezzar here in 2019. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phyllis Gove.
And today we are so excited to, one, have Emily Vanderwerf on the podcast with us. She is the critic at large?
Critic at large, yes.
Would it be the critic at large or a critic at large?
The critic at large.
There
isn't another one yet.
Excellent.
Yeah. I'm keeping them at bay.
The critic at large at Vox Media. And she's joined us to do one of the finest films ever made, The Matrix.
It really is. You know, I have to say, first of all, we went to see it together on the 20th anniversary to the day of its release on March 31st at the Arclight.
Which was also the 10th trans day of visibility,
which was a nice a nice little connection there. I had not seen it on the big screen since 99. I don't know if you had.
No, that was my first time seeing it on the screen, big screen since 99, yeah.
And we talked about it, at length when we left the theater, but it just really fucking hit me.
Yeah.
How, we've talked a little bit of this on text too, but this movie is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. But when you see it that big and you see just how expansive and just every corner of this movie is thought through and brilliant. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There isn't an inch of it that isn't, either fun or thoughtful or just cool. Like, it's just, it really, really, I don't know.
I noticed that too. I watched on my iPhone in bed at 2 a.m.
As the Wachowskis wanted.
Which is really how I watched it.
I also want to say, some people say Wachowski, but I looked online and it is Wachowski.
Wachowski, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Just to be clear that is, just because I don't want it to sound like we're mispronouncing their name. Mm-hmm. It is... We talked a little bit about this on our throw to this episode, but – and maybe you'll just – obviously we want to hear your thoughts on this as well. Is there a movie that left a bigger footprint?
From 99.
From 99.
Phantom Menace.
See, that's what I said. He didn't even think it –
Phantom Menace –
I don't know if it's bigger, but it's comparable.
Phantom Menace, the idea of digital environments, digital creations, like that's a big thing we live with right now. But also the whole idea of like resurrecting an old IP is like the old, like literally now we're in an era where people are trying to do that with The Matrix. Like,
which will happen.
I understand that point, but that doesn't seem like that was born of Phantom Menace. Mm. That seems like Phantom Menace. I mean, the first part was for sure. And also kind of it was the first time they did kind of the grafting on people's faces, emotions, mm-hmm. as well. So that's obviously you know, kept on. But that is a little more inside baseball-y to me. With The Matrix, in terms of storytelling, in terms of the themes it presented, in terms of its effect on science fiction and kind of filmmaking at large, I don't think there's anything
that really
comes close.
Yes. I mean,
maybe Fight Club, to be honest. But
I think that – and maybe this is short-sighted or what have you. But I think that from a pure production perspective,
right,
this film had – I mean, Bullet Time – and what we saw, I mean, what they were able to accomplish from a sheer just actual production element of it, I think is pretty unprecedented.
It's incredible.
I mean, there's a great IO9 article talking about the moment that things changed, the moment that The Matrix felt sort of unlike anything else. And I'd love to hear how you guys first saw it as well. But I went to see it. I saw an early screening of it before it had been released. I think it was a couple days, maybe a week or so beforehand. My friend Dimitri came to the video store that I was working at the time and had one of – do you remember the cardstock movie tickets? Do you remember what those used to be like?
Sure.
Where it was like – and it had – it looked like a photocopied poster and it said like admit to or something like that. Like it was an actual like
– yeah.
You know, and he came and he was like, hey, I got tickets to see this. Do you want to see it? And
you heard of it?
No.
I don't think I'd heard of it either.
I didn't even know what it was. I think that Keanu was a little bit in the wilderness at this point. I didn't feel like people really knew or cared as much about him. And I was like, this Keanu Reeves in a movie called The Matrix? Like it really didn't mean fucking anything to me, but it was free. And I was like, sure, I'll go and see it.
It has a real – if it didn't become what it became, it has a real direct-to-video vibe.
100%.
So,
I mean, he's done Johnny Mnemonic a couple years previous. Yeah. He's kind of been in this lane before.
If it failed, he would have been a direct-to-video guy.
For sure.
So
Lawrence Fishburne.
Also
a guy that hadn't, you know, Carrie Ann Moss obviously wasn't anything at that point. Mm-hmm. Joey Pants was sort of, you know, indie. But like, so I went to see it and I remember I had a theater that no longer exists in Toronto. The movie starts and I immediately thought to myself, well, this looks really slick. I don't think I had seen Bound up until that point. I'm pretty sure that I hadn't. And when she fucking goes up and the camera goes around her, the audience just screamed and lost their shit. And I got goosebumps and I was just like, this is like, – it just felt like an absolute game changer. You just felt like you would never – and I'm not convinced – I am convinced that I have not seen anything like it since. I've never been in a movie since.
One other movie I can remember that felt like that, Crouching Tiger.
But yeah,
Crouching Tiger, just because it was so naturalistic too. I didn't expect those that kind of visuals in that environment.
Sure. Yeah.
But that's it.
But it was a moment where I just truly felt like cinema changed. In that moment, I saw something I had never seen before. And the IO9 writer, you know, he's an older guy than I am. He went to see Back to the Future in the theater. He had seen like, you know, movies that we look at as hallmarks of our childhood. And it's just unlike anything I'd ever seen before. And I left the theater. I will say this. When he flies at the end, I kind of laughed. And I was like, what? But now I'm just like, fuck yeah.
With Wake Up playing, I thought it was the greatest thing.
But at the time, I was just fucking jaded 19-year-old or whatever. And just being like, why is he flying? Like, I didn't even think it was – like that it was a bridge to another movie. I was just like, what, he flies now? Like, I just didn't – I just honestly just didn't get it.
You were a jerk. One other movie I could think of that had that kind of effect on me. It just came out.
Uh-oh.
Into the Spider-Verse.
Really?
Yeah, Into the Spider. And we said this to Miguel when he was here. This and Matrix feels very similar to me in that Matrix was so far beyond what I thought was capable at the time.
Yeah.
And I feel that way about Spider-Verse. Spider-Verse looks like nothing I've seen, no animated film I'd ever seen, and also no superhero film I'd ever seen or even thought of.
Yeah.
So many steps beyond that we now are filling in the blanks between whatever came before it and Spider-Verse. And I actually don't know if we've ever filled in all the blanks to Matrix.
No, I would agree with that. I mean, I think that – because you were texting me a little bit about that idea of what other movies – what other sci-fi movies come even close to sort of having the impact that this movie had.
From the last 20 years.
And I said Inception, and I will say this. Inception doesn't exist without The Matrix. I'm not going to say that it can. The hallway sequence, when it's turning, and the car – that was the closest, I think, for me in a theater being like, this is a symphony of image and thought, and like all of it's just really colliding in a beautiful way. But again, that's a sequence in that movie, a movie that I really love. But The Matrix does that basically for 2 hours and 20 minutes.
It also has a I know that they made Bound before, but it also has an Orson Welles quality to it, which is where did these people come from? Whereas Nolan at that point was – you're expecting.
Well, Prestige into incredible. Dark Knight into Inception.
Yeah, and he had done Memento at that point. You're expecting something of that caliber. You got it.
What was your experience like seeing it for the first time?
And I also want to know what other sci-fi movies you think.
I was going to say it depends how you classify it. I think The Avengers is – definitely. Everybody's. No, yeah, absolutely.
Controlling the weather.
Yeah, no. Everybody's chasing that first Joss Whedon Avengers, final battle. Yeah. Like that. Everybody's still trying to get there and they can't quite.
That is a symphony, too.
I think you could maybe make an argument for Black Panther, but more on the level of representation than filmmaking craft. Mm-hmm. But that movie's representation is phenomenal. And that's why people are so. Feel like they need to fill in the blanks to get to Black Panther.
Yeah.
But yeah, my first experience seeing The Matrix, this may surprise our listeners to hear, but I am a trans woman. when I was in high school, I was kind of obsessed with The Matrix. I saw it with my then girlfriend. When the bug goes down his belly button, I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
That was my I'm in, you know, even though it terrified me and I was freaked out by it. It really felt to me like the idea that you could go online and you could be anyone. And that's as far as I let that thought get at 18. And I was like, we're not going to go any further with that. But yeah, there was something in this movie that I keyed into that I spent the next 20 years unraveling. And that for me, seeing it, and it was several weeks after it had come out. It was probably 6 to 8 weeks after it had come out. And it was, we were about the only people in the theater, my girlfriend, Katie and I. And we sat there kind of in the dark, and a lot of it had been spoiled for me by that point. A lot of the big sequences. I hadn't heard about this bug thing, and I was like, what the fuck is going on? I do find sometimes that when sci-fi stuff goes into the movies, people frequently are like, oh my God, what an original concept. Do you remember that short World of Tomorrow? The Don Hertzfeldt one. It's animated. It's about a girl from the future going back and meeting her childhood self or something. Mm-hmm. I saw that movie and everybody was like, what an original wild concept. And I read a lot of sci-fi. So I was like, this is not all that new. And I felt that way with The Matrix. A lot of it is from comics, science fiction novels, things like that. But the way it was put together felt super new. And I don't know that we've ever quite gotten there yet. Certainly there are filmmakers out there who could make something like this, but they're all being sort of shunted into franchise stuff. So they don't have the freedom. Ryan Coogler doesn't have the freedom to make something like this. He found his own freedom within this studio system. Mm-hmm. But what the Wachowskis got here, The Matrix, the reason I think it's not as influential as Phantom Menace is because that freedom starts to go away almost immediately after this comes out.
Except for them.
It's just so
– Except they've had –
Yeah, but now they're done. They're saying they're done.
I just saw that it was Lily is –
Lily's doing a TV show,
For Showtime.
But it seems like she's just supervising someone. I got was that it was someone else's show that she's supervising, but
– Well, and Lana's made it pretty clear that she's done.
Yeah, Lana seems like she's more interested in political activism right now. Yeah. I really don't blame her. I mean,
they've shut down their Chicago production office.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
– It sounds like Lily found this lesbian – comedian from Chicago that she really likes and is helping shepherd this TV show. But as far as the two of them doing another movie, Jupiter Ascending kind of shut that down, unfortunately. And then Sense8 was just not as big a thing as it, could have been, as I think Netflix thought it was going to be.
I have to say I did not give Sense8 enough of a shot.
It's interesting because this kind of does fall into the argument we have almost every day about Netflix. And I wonder how Sense8 would have been received if it was on any other platform.
Right.
Netflix does have this thing where even it's – and I think the people who watch Sense8 seem to really like it.
Oh, really loved it.
It's a good show.
Yeah, really like it. So I wonder if it was on any other platform, including Amazon, including Hulu, if it would have had more of a kind of resonance. But
it did also launch at a weird time for
its own shit.
Well, that, but also I feel like – to your point, it launched pretty early in the days of Netflix.
Yeah, you know, I think it was fifth or sixth show.
It was early enough that I think they were expecting a splashier show or a splashier, at least embracing of the show, which it didn't get. And then they just kind of, to your point, became one of a bunch of shows and they stopped caring. And then there was a huge, fierce calling when it was canceled at the end of season two for some sort of resolution. And then they did a kind of a Christmas specialty thing from what
I heard. They did a two and a half hour movie that they concluded with an orgy. That was, you know.
Sure, as you do. Yeah.
A psychic pansexual orgy, which is like if that's how the – I guess Lily was not as involved in Sense8, but if that's how the Wachowskis' career as directors, a pair, closes out, perfect. Couldn't ask for a better way to go out.
I mean, it's funny. We talked about this a little bit too is when we left the theater for The Matrix, but – you know, Blank Check has really made me reorient a lot of filmmakers for me. A lot of films reappraise a lot of movies that I hadn't thought of, or at least in the same way. And the Wachowskis are probably at the top of that list of filmmakers who I respected.
I thought you always kind of liked everything they've done.
No.
You didn't like Cloud Atlas?
No.
And you didn't like Speed Racer?
No.
Oh, okay.
Wow. And I'm sorry. I know. I've come around.
I'm surprised. That's all.
No, I wanted to. They are the type of – I mean, I think that the collective film-going community wanted everything that they touched after this movie to be as good as this movie. I think we were all rooting for them to be the greatest filmmakers that ever were. And I remember seeing Reloaded, admittedly hungover, opening weekend, and did not like it. I was just, and part of it is I was hungover.
Well, I don't like Reloaded and I don't like Revolutions and I don't see myself ever liking either of those movies, but I do like Speed Racer and I do like Cloud Atlas.
If you can see Emily's face right now, just processing.
Do you like Reloaded and Revolutions?
I don't actually believe this, but I could write an article arguing that Reloaded is better than The Matrix.
Roger Ebert did.
He did?
His reviews are bizarre, which we'll get into in a second.
I think Revolutions clearly shows for being made at the same time as Reloaded, and they were just fucking sick of it. I think it's better than I remembered. I watched all of them earlier this year, around the time of the 20th anniversary. But I think Reloaded is genuinely daring and interesting and well-made in a way that people don't give it credit for because – it wasn't what they were expecting. And I think that time has been kinder to that movie than people would have expected.
I think it's been kinder to both of them.
I'll watch it again.
I really will
because I love –
I think you like them a lot more than you remember.
I like The Matrix more after this rewatch than I ever liked it. And again, it was my fifth movie this year and one of the main reasons I wanted to do this podcast. So I will watch it again. And in the truth, that's actually true for all the Wachowskis movies.
That was my
Speed Racer watch. I was like, what is this? First Cloud Atlas watch. I couldn't get through it. So I almost want to watch Jupiter Ascending again. So.
I will say, and this is sort of was my point on the Blank Check of it all, which is they really just sort of, they opened my mind to what they're specifically more David Sims in terms of what they were trying to do. Things that I was not locked into or under or open to that now I'm just like, oh, they're just better than everybody else. Like they're just ahead of everybody else.
Yeah.
And that's why Reloaded and Revolutions, I mean, that trilogy, I remember I got in arguments with people when I first moved out here. A friend of mine, Barrett, I remember getting in a big sort of discussion with him and him talking about how rich that whole trilogy is and me being very dismissive of the other two films because that was sort of, to your point, not what we expected.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting. Reloaded and Revolutions are fascinating films. I have my issues with them, and I do think this is arguably still my favorite of the trilogy, but it's just there's no one doing what they did and had done, and I'm bummed that they're not going to make more, quite honestly. But
yeah,
we can hope that maybe they
Soderbergh's making
I think they will. I think they will when the world political situation abruptly resolves itself. We fix climate change.
Oh, yeah?
Like all these things we're going to do in the next 2 or 3 years. And then they're going to be like, all right, we're going to make some more movies.
The world is okay again.
Yeah.
No, that sounds
the world is safe for our films.
So I'm going to read the synopsis of The Matrix for the two people that don't know what The Matrix is about. Neo, played
my
by
my mom and dad, who I actually saw this movie with.
Really?
Saw it with my family. Yeah, on a vacation.
Really?
And I think we all liked it. I know I loved it.
Oh, I'm sure.
I think my parents liked it.
Really?
Yeah.
I think – I don't know if my – my mom definitely saw it and probably liked it. But so Neo, played by Keanu Reeves, believes that Morpheus, played by Lawrence Fishburne, an elusive figure considered to be the most dangerous man alive, can answer his question, what is the Matrix? Neo is contacted by Trinity, played by Carrie-Anne Moss, a beautiful stranger who leads him into an underworld where he meets Morpheus. This is the strangest fucking logline. They fight a brutal battle for their lives against a cadre of – vicious intelligence secret agents. It is the truth that could cost Neo something more precious than his life. Well, guys, you've
seen
the Matrix.
Matrix. <laughs> Right?
That's the Matrix.
They're still trying to keep the twist.
Yeah, they're trying to.
They're trying to keep it a secret.
They're trying to keep it a secret.
Do you remember how the marketing around this was just bizarre? What is the,
Matrix? Matrix?
And like, I think that was the direct-to-video vibe of it all. It felt like an ARG for a video game.
It really did. Warner Brothers didn't do this film any favors. They didn't
Well, it worked.
It did work, but I do think that it did reek of a marketing campaign by a studio that didn't – they knew they had something. They didn't know how to convey it to other people. It's kind of similar in its own way to how they didn't really know how to market Inception, how they didn't really know how to market – like it's just – it's stuff like that where they're just like, we have something great and we just hope that we don't fuck this up, and in the process they kind of don't do a great job.
Both of those movies had a word of mouth, you got to see this vibe.
True.
Yeah.
You know? And there was almost no way to fuck it up. Like, they're – again, they're kind of the two most important science fiction movies of the last 20 years.
Yep.
I guess you're right. It was not the greatest marketing campaign, but whatever. They got the word out the
left. Sorry, go ahead.
You know what other sci-fi movies had as big a footprint as this? Mm. Detective Pikachu.
You want to go down the Pikachu
everybody,
road?
Everybody loves it. It's universally beloved.
We just went 10 minutes up Pikachu before you got here.
Yeah. We weren't big fans. I think it's interesting too. So the Matrix opens on March 31st, 1999, first place, $27.8 million against 10 Things I Hate About You and The Out-of-Towners. It would go on to make 400.
When was it released?
What the fuck is The Out-of-Towners?
Steve Martin, Goldie Hawn remake of the
Jesus. Yeah.
We'll be doing it soon.
Yeah,
we'll
come back on for that one. You'll be here for you and Libby.
It's a shitty movie, and Libby will be here.
She loves it. It would go on to make $463 million on a $63 million budget.
Is that worldwide or domestic?
That's worldwide.
What weekend did it come out? What time?
March 31st, 1999. Yeah, so, right. Which is a smart release date for it.
Is that Easter that year?
Yes, that's the Easter weekend. Okay. Yeah. They wanted to get – and it was a Wednesday. So they opened a couple days early to try to capitalize on that, which was smart.
Right.
And truthfully, I don't think Phantom Menace got out from underneath it.
No.
Ever. Like, I think that movie comes out and it just kills, and no one saw it coming, and no one knew how big it was going to be. No one knew how cool it was going to be, and it just out-cooled Star Wars. Like, Star Wars made more money, obviously, and Star Wars had kids and all of that, but The Matrix was a hard R, and it was just the fucking coolest movie that's ever been, and you can't touch that.
It's kind of like when South Park did that bit about Family Guy, how they come up with their jokes.
With the manatees?
Yeah. With the manatees. Do you remember this?
Yeah, I do. Were
you going with this?
It's the out-cooling thing. It didn't like kill the Family Guy franchise, but it made me feel like a loser
for watching Family Guy
from that point forward.
That's funny.
I think this kind of
that's
has
fair.
A similar
that's
thing.
That's fair. Yeah. I get that. Yeah.
There's definitely things where like somebody will say a thing or you'll see a thing and it just like –
to go, yeah.
It shatters the glass for you in terms of like, can I enjoy this anymore? You know?
I think that it also just – we were expecting Star Wars to be groundbreaking, which was maybe an unreal expectation.
But what were you going to do? We didn't know anything else at that point.
No, I know. But I just mean – I mean in general.
There was no Matrix.
Right.
No, I know what you're saying. But Star Wars – we were right. We were right to feel that way and have that expectation for those movies.
Yeah, but it just goes to show that, I mean, first of all, originality, we really should be embracing that, but also just, you know,
more than ever.
No, seriously. But it's just, I think that was maybe the thing that hit me the hardest was I've never seen anything like this before. And Star Wars was inevitably going to feel familiar.
Yeah.
And then familiar on top of also way aged down in the hopes of it's just death, or at least at the time it was. I think that people are, you know, reappraising the prequels in their own way and finding ways to love them a little bit. But and I actually would say that the best thing that can be said, or one of the best things that can be said about the new Star Wars movies, mm-hmm. Is that they found a way to kind of warm you up to what existed in these other films and make it all feel very kind of somewhat cohesive, for what that's worth. This is something that's interesting. The Matrix has 88% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 85% from audiences, which feels low to me.
Yeah, and this is kind of the early era of – like I think Rotten Tomatoes launched in 98, 99. Yes. Yeah. So like these are original reviews it's counting. A lot of the time when you get like a classic movie, the reviews that they're counting are like not release reviews but like re-release reviews.
Like DVD reviews.
This is definitely the response to it. And I kind of remember that there were a lot of people who were deeply confused by this movie. Like the idea that there are multiple layers of reality really throws people every time it comes out. Not even that. Like Inception, I found incredibly easy to follow. And a lot of people are like, oh my God, what the fuck is
that? Where am I?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think that's the point with both of these movies. I think that's the brilliance of these two movies is they seem a lot more complex than they actually are. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. This is very easy to understand what they're talking about here. And they do this thing. I mean, it's like – it's not the best show of all time, but does this really well. With 13 Reasons Why. What they did to differentiate between the past and the future with the kid having, I think the black eye or something like, or the cut on his face or whatever.
Yeah.
So you always knew with the portal in the back of Neo's head or everyone's head. It's very easy to kind of tell where you are.
Oh, that's interesting.
At all times.
Oh, yeah.
And that's it for me. That's enough to kind of understand that there's this world where they look like this and they have the portals, and there's this world where they don't and they're walking around like real people. I think that's so simple and visual makes it so easy.
I'm sorry, but the second that Zion becomes part of, you know what I mean? Like once we see that world,
that's which Reloaded. Is so
– sorry? No. I'm talking about like – or the Nebuchadnezzar. I'm saying that once he's pulled out of the Matrix and if you're really lost, like if you're really confused – but I'm not saying you. I mean
the youth. No, I know.
I'm just like, what are you confused about right now? Like you've got this slick green-tinted world where everyone looks like a fucking badass, and then you've got everybody looking – they're eating oatmeal and they look like – it's clearly two different consciousnesses.
You also have Morpheus literally tell you what's happening.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But people get lost in exposition, I find, if there's a lot of it. Like
this one does – they do a good job.
They do a terrific job. Quick. I think again, Inception does a terrific job. Another one, you know, anytime though you start to introduce different levels of reality, like there are people who want flowcharts, you know. Yeah. Basically what kind of bogs down Interstellar for me is these segments where they're like, we're going to draw this on a whiteboard. What's happening? I love Interstellar,
but it's also
got a lot of places where it just kind of – everything stops. So we can learn about physics.
Moves like a freight train, and its exposition is so beautifully delineated into the story. Yeah. It's
that's like the improv thing where it's just go ahead and tell people what's happening, and then move past it. It's sometimes it's just worth it to just throw the exposition at them and just move past it. I don't love that in Inception. You know, like that 45-minute thing where he's just explaining the world to Ellen Page. But you need it. Yeah. I feel like you need it, and you get the rules across really well that way. And then I can really enjoy the last 2 hours of that movie.
Yeah, so. I agree with that. So I'm going to read a chunk of Roger Ebert's somewhat baffling review of The Matrix.
What did he give it? What are the stars?
He gave it 3 stars.
Okay.
He says, The Matrix is a visually dazzling cyber adventure full of kinetic excitement, but it retreats to a formula just when it's getting interesting. It's kind of a letdown when a movie begins by redefining the nature of reality and ends with a shootout. We want a leap of imagination, not one of those obligatory climaxes with automatic weapons fire. Too bad, because the setup is intriguing. Do you want me to finish before you?
Fuck you.
Okay.
All right, go ahead.
Too bad, because the setup is intriguing. The Matrix recycles the premise of Dark City and Strange Days, turns up the heat, the volume, and borrows the gravity-defying choreography of Hong Kong action movies. It's fun, but it could have been more. Both Dark City and Strange Days offered intriguing motivations for villainy. The Matrix is more like a superhero comic book in which the fate of the world comes down to a titanic fistfight between the designated representatives of good and evil. It's cruel, really, to put tantalizing ideas on the table and then ask the audience to be satisfied with a shootout and a martial arts duel. The Matrix did not bore me. It interested me so much indeed that I wanted to be challenged even more. I wanted it to follow its material to audacious conclusions to arrive not simply at victory but a revelation. I wanted an ending that was transformational like Dark Cities and not one that simply throws us sensational action sequences. I wanted, in short, a third act. So Kenny and I texted a little bit about this. And Roger Ebert's love of Dark City baffles both of us.
I have one point to make before we get into that, which okay. I could talk about for hours. He sounded like Armand White in that review. Like, really?
He still gave it 3 stars. It's just it's all backhanded compliments.
It's this Armand White thing, or Armand White, whatever, thing where I happen to love his reviews. Right? Like, I love, yeah. I do. I find them endlessly fascinating. I find them challenging. I really, really like reading them, but I also see what he's doing.
Yeah.
And it's that Armand White thing where he takes something that everyone that says is good and says, oh, but it's not nearly as good as this thing that I only saw at like the Venice Film Festival 6 years ago. or this other thing that only like I remember from 30 years ago. That's the only time Roger Ebert has ever pulled that shit. And it's with his little pet project. Dark City. I know. Okay, so that's
also Roger Ebert does that a lot, though. Like, he latches on to mostly he kind of undercuts he wasn't a big fan of the Lord of the Rings movies.
Neither am I.
And he wasn't a huge fan of there's a lot of some of those genre things in this window. He gets a little why is this so violent? Why does it end with a shootout? I love Dark City. I think The Matrix is better, but I do love Dark City. So.
I mean, I also feel like The Matrix was written before Dark City, so stop making it seem as though The Matrix is ripping off Dark City and Strange Days. It's a little bit crazy to me. But I just also...
Well, you also... Both these movies can exist.
Of course they can.
Speaking as a critic at large, as the critic at large,
that's what we've heard. Yeah.
I think this is a thing critics do that audiences frequently misinterpret, where we're like, okay, this is like this thing, and people are like, oh, you're saying it's ripping it off. And no, we're talking about there was something in the water in the late 90s that was like, we don't live in reality, and Strange Days and Dark City and The Matrix are all circling that theme in very different ways. I think if you pinned Roger Ebert down, he'd never say they were that similar, but they were around kind of the same ideas. But I think audiences read that and don't see that shorthand. They see it as, oh, this movie is just like those movies and it's ripping them
off. But I think I would agree with you, and I certainly don't mean to put words in his mouth. I do wonder, though, he seems to have – an appreciation or more affection for the influences that Dark City had versus the he's not,
he calls it Metropolis. I mean,
he's not interested in the kung fu movies and the action influences, because Dark City is not really an action movie. Dark City is a noir.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so Ebert likes noir movies more, and that's fine. I mean, that's a taste thing. That's fine. But don't deride.
That's what that
the influences.
It feels to me as if he's saying a quote unquote Hong Kong action movie is invalid in some way.
I disagree with his ultimate conclusions. I don't disagree with that review. I think that review is more or less accurate, and I could tell you who I think agrees with him, and it's the Wachowskis, because the next two movies are literally speaking to his point.
Which is why he likes Reloaded a lot, and he doesn't like Revolutions, but he really likes Reloaded because he feels like Reloaded is the movie that this tees up, right? Yeah. I mean, it goes into the real sort of the depth of consciousness and so I appreciate that. And again, it's not a bad review. It's just interesting when I looked through all the reviews. Obviously, I tried to cherry pick the stuff that I felt was the most appropriate. But what I was really hit with was the flood of people that loved – the filmmakers that loved this movie. I mean, first of all, not a filmmaker, but William Gibson talks about – obviously, Neuromancer was a huge part. He talks about how Neo is his favorite science fiction hero ever, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Joss Whedon calls it his number one movie and praises its storytelling, structure, and depth, says it works on whatever level you want to bring to it. Aronofsky says he walked out of The Matrix and was thinking, what kind of science fiction movie can people make now? The Wachowskis basically took all the greatest sci-fi ideas of the 20th century and rolled them into a delicious pop culture sandwich that everyone on the planet devoured.
Yeah.
M. Night Shyamalan loved it. And Simon Pegg said something which sort of taps into what we were talking about. He said that The Matrix provided the excitement and satisfaction The Phantom Menace failed to inspire. The Matrix seemed fresh and cool and visually breathtaking, making wonderful, intelligent use of CG to augment the on-screen action, striking a perfect balance of the real and hyper-real. It's possibly the coolest film I've ever seen. It really is just people that were you know, that were ready for it, that were ready to kind of allow this movie into their lives, really, really loved it. And I think some people had barriers. It feels a little bit like Ebert had some barriers that he wasn't really willing to kind of let it in.
Yeah, I think that's true. I do want to think about like Peg Aronofsky, that kind of generation is – this is also the rise of Ain't It Cool News, like this era. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about how Phantom Menace never escaped this movie. And a dark side of that is that idea that a thing had to be darker to be cool. Sure. That Ain't It Cool News, that – that generation of film geeks who still a lot of them are writing online and have like really great jobs, like that. So they sort of propagated that idea. And I think it was kind of a poisonous idea. And like, that's where we start to get what leads into things like Gamergate and the, I hate female Ghostbusters. And like, there's this whole
or Captain Marvel.
And like, what's crazy about The Matrix is that that movie is part of this discussion, even though it's made by two trans women. It's a movie about liberation. It's a movie about like tearing down capitalism, basically. But it's read as a movie about like tearing down feminism. And like that's a wild thing to happen to this movie, which speaks to, I think, Joss Whedon's point that anything you want to bring to this movie, you can read into it, which is a great thing and also sometimes not so great.
Well, it feels like that feels like a good entry point to talk about this red pill situation.
Sure is.
Because I'm going to be perfectly frank. I didn't know much about it. And by that, I mean, I did a little bit of reading on this insane misinterpretation of this movie. But so for the people that don't know, and myself sort of included a little bit, the red pill idea is that there are women that have taken the red pill.
No.
Or there's – okay, sorry. Okay.
The idea is that you, Phil
– don't throw me in this.
As a cisgender man
okay.
in 2019 America are being held down by social justice causes, meaning non-white people, meaning women, meaning LGBT people, and that the
– cis-white allies. Mm-hmm.
They're
suppressing.
So you're one of the good people in this. Well, one of the bad people.
Yeah, you're an ally, and you are like, so you would be written off as what's called an NPC. I'm going way down the rabbit hole now. But like the idea is that once you take the red pill, you see the ways that society is trying to keep straight cis white men like yourself down.
So, okay, you know? So I misinterpreted it. The men in this equation are the ones that have taken the red pill.
Mm-hmm.
The men who see the world for what it quote-unquote
means. I see.
And certainly there are women and people of color and LGBT people who have taken the red pill and also feel like, yes, men are at a disadvantage. And here's the thing is they're not always wrong. Like men, for instance, are often disadvantaged in custody hearings. Men, like they can point to all sorts of things like men are struggling with mental illness. Men are struggling with the suicide epidemic. Like they're not wrong. The problems are just not where they think they are. You know, like the root causes are not, don't lie in like feminism. The root causes lie in like capitalism, patriarchy, like all of these things that make it like if you are a man who struggles with a mental illness that make it there's a stigma against you going to get help for that.
Stereotypical
you know?
Gender roles. Yeah. Yes, very much so. I mean, the two things you brought up are perfect examples of that.
Mm-hmm.
That men are supposed to feel a certain way or do a certain thing in our patriarchal society.
But there does seem to and forgive me because the article that I read was speaking more from the female perspective. This idea that there are women that. There are like pro red pill women, I guess.
Yeah. Is there's that the best the, way of putting the it? YouTuber Lacey Green. I don't know if she still identifies as having red pilled. Identifies as having red pilled. What a world we live in. But she was like a really pro LGBT, all that stuff, pro feminist sex advice person on YouTube. And she started dating kind of a right winger and then slowly like trended toward red pill. And then she like did a video called How I've Been Red Pilled and everybody got mad at her. I don't know what happened after that. Like she's kind of been,
she went into hiding.
Yeah. She's kind of under the radar now. She still does stuff. And like, it sounds like she's kind of drifted away from that, but it's still like, and I hate to be like, oh, she only did it because she was dating this guy, because that doesn't give her any agency in her own decisions. But also, like, that was the timeline. And so that's what people read into it. So, but yeah, there are women who have red-pilled. There are people of color who have red-pilled. There are
whatever. I guess I'm just sort of – what I find kind of shocking about all of this is – and I guess it taps into what you were saying about how this film is so kind of brilliantly about – that like breaking the boundaries of identity and what it means to be you and all of that, mm-hmm. that it creates a text that can be so misinterpreted.
Right.
It is this curse and blessing of how, you know, well made this movie is. And yet at the same time, I watch it and think to myself, you got to really want it. Like, this red pill stuff is so sweaty to me. Like, you have to just really the gymnastics and the way you have to bend yourself into a pretzel in order to get this thing to sort of fit your thing.
I don't think it is at all.
I agree.
Really?
I agree with you, Emily.
I think it's like a movie you guys are going to talk about, Fight Club, where there is this idea. Like, if you watch that movie, to me, it's very hard to watch that movie and not realize it's criticizing these guys' mindset. Well,
yes, it's clearly a satire, but yeah.
At the same time, I watch a lot of movies. I'm steeped in that kind of world. And
fair enough.
The thing about The Matrix, the thing about American Beauty, the thing about Fight Club, they're all criticizing the emptiness of late 20th century capitalism, the emptiness of the white-centric patriarchal society that we lived in. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to if you don't look beyond the surface level, that's kind of hard to see.
I want to take on those three movies because I think they do – because I think they illustrate a point I want to make really well.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's a danger to making a movie specifically like Fight Club. I think, Phil, I think I agree with you, and I think I agree with you, Emily. Basically, the idea, like somewhere in the middle, basically the idea that you have to want to misinterpret Matrix, but it's not so much the mental gymnastics. I think it is. It's willfully ignoring a lot of what's
the
happening.
The signs of it. Sure.
And just basically saying the central idea of this, which is all reality is not real. And there is a reality if you are actually just looking beyond what we see in front of us. Mm-hmm. And that could be applied to anyone's mindset or mm-hmm. anyone's sense of victimhood, which I think is really what's going on with, you know, these men's right activists mm-hmm. who feel like they're being held down by some kind of system. Fight Club, I think, is a brilliant film. And I think I, you know, agree with you 100% that it's very obviously a criticism of capitalism, commercialism, and, you know, male toxicity. But there is a little danger in making a movie like that. Now, I'm not saying it shouldn't be made, mm-hmm. but I'm just saying we should go into those with our eyes open. And then I would say American Beauty tips over.
Yeah.
And I think American Beauty may want to present itself as it's a criticism of, you know, the white male patriarchy.
Sure.
We did this movie for the first – it's a celebration of it.
I think the one movie this year that does – plays with these themes and doesn't tip over into a world where you can misread them is Being John Malkovich, which is a movie about all of this stuff about a white guy who thinks he needs to have everything and ultimately like he is destroyed because of that. Mm-hmm. Spoilers for Being John Malkovich.
Yeah, yeah.
But mm-hmm. like that's the one movie that like does all this stuff. It's my favorite movie of this year.
Same.
It's another weird trans allegory in another way.
Yeah, yeah. I think this actually in a lot of ways taps into there's this book that just came out recently called Best Movie Year Ever that Brian Raftery wrote, and is actually he's going to be on our podcast hopefully in the next couple weeks. And he has a whole chapter on
talking about the Out of Towners.
Yes,
yeah. Oh, his favorite movie. His favorite movie of 99.
Weirdly, and it talks a little bit about. So the Wachowskis had a manager, mm-hmm. I believe, Mattis, who became circulating their script in 95, right around the time of the internet. And I think that the internet is really sort of, I mean, for obvious, is the nucleus of all of this. It's where everyone sort of gets to either be the person they really want to be,
right,
or a person that they think they want to be, or maybe it's just a way of just, you know, being – a version of yourself that whatever it is, the internet sort of is this floodgate and changes everything. And it feels like that sort of bendable reality, if you will, is what really makes not just this movie possible from a logistical perspective in terms of its plot, but also for it to tap into the stuff that we're talking about here as well.
Yeah. I was actually going to sort of draw upon that point, which is, and I'm going to sidle alongside some trans stuff here. Which is, if you are especially a white guy in America, and especially if you live in a small town, if you live in a rural area, if you live in an economically disadvantaged area, your social structures are gone. Like, right. I came of age in an area where, like, there, when I was a kid, there were like bowling leagues, there was the Kiwanis Club, there were the Lions Club, there were these structures that men found meaning in, and like, this is one of the wild things about coming out as trans is like those structures still exist for women.
Mm-hmm.
For a man, you kind of have to invent them. You kind of have to be like, this is my friend. I'm going to go out with him every month or so. We're going to have drinks. Like you kind of have to create these, and that's easier to do in a city. Like I had a reasonably good social life with other men when I thought I was a man in Los Angeles, but like societally speaking, those structures continue to exist for women in a way they haven't for men, mm-hmm. especially in these smaller areas. And like the internet has stepped into that void. And we look like I, for a long time, spent writing an article that never got published at the AV Club about World of Warcraft as like a new version of a bowling league. And like people who were in there were in guilds, and like, it was a great way for them to have that sort of camaraderie. And like, that's what's great about the internet. What's bad about the internet is that I can watch one video on YouTube that has like the Lacey Green video we're talking about, which I don't think is a bad video. I think she's honestly trying to grapple with some of this stuff, but you keep following that chain and you end up falling further and further down this rabbit hole. And that's very similar to taking the red pill in the Matrix. So like, I think the internet is the reason for a lot of this, not just in terms of like exploring different identities and exploring different levels of reality, but in terms of like, I found a community here and it helps me define myself, and I define myself by hating women.
I mean,
and that's what the Matrix is about.
I get it. I obviously don't agree with it, but I get how you can get there.
No, I do.
Well,
no, it's, no offense, not a matter of agreeing with it. It's a fact.
Yeah, I know.
It's like what Emily was just saying. It's a fact. It's as bigotry has become less and less societally acceptable,
mm-hmm.
and progressive issues have become more and more societally acceptable. Mm-hmm. Right? The things that in the beginning of the internet, specifically, kids who were disadvantaged, underprivileged, outcasts in their community were able to find these communities on the internet, and it was positive.
Mm-hmm.
Today, I think these kind of bigots, you know, specifically like men's rights activists, white supremacists, Nazis, gun enthusiasts, terrorists, people like that find their communities online, and the internet has metastasized into something that's really, truly scary. And then, you know, the Matrix to me is like 20 years down the road or 50 years down the road,
mm-hmm.
where none of that really even matters anymore. But yeah, I think that our wokeness in real life has given way. And I'm not saying this is like a bad outcome globally, but our general wokeness in real life has given birth to this really, really scary, seedy, truly terrifying underbelly that we can actually see because it's right there in 4chan, you know?
Well, let me go one step deeper than that, which is these movies are very critical of capitalism. Capitalism in 2019 America likes to appear woke. Like brands.
For sure.
We're recording this at the start of Pride Month. It's coming out in Pride Month, I believe. Mm-hmm. So like brands are, you know, putting their rainbow stuff up. Like there's a trans rights Budweiser can you can buy in the UK. Like, I mean, Budweiser, great. Yay. But like,
yeah, Gillette just had an ad with a trans man.
It was a really nice ad.
And like, yeah. This is the thing. Because of the way the US political system is set up, these people don't have a lot of cultural power because the corporations have, I think, quite rightly seen which way the world is trending, but they have a lot of political power because of the Electoral College, because of all of these different things that like allow them with certain quirks of fate to get Donald Trump in the White House. And like, that's sort of the tension here is like, there is this feeling of like, you know, everywhere I look, people are trying to get me to accept something I don't, you know, necessarily agree with. And like, I'm a vaguely visible trans woman now. And like, I have to like, I get emails from people where I have to be like, no, that's not how it is, you know? And it's like, there has been that process of there are a lot of people who feel like they were left behind in one way or another, and they're taking aim at the wrong target.
Who's the right target?
I mean, I think the right target is that we live in a world that is, you know, that is set up to benefit an increasingly small number of people who have a lot of money already and want more money. I don't want to like advocate for outright like communism or something on your podcast, but like deregulated capitalism is a scourge, you know, and it's ruined and torn apart the meaning that a lot of people have in their lives. And then you look at like the decay of religious institutions, of community organizations, of things that gave people social meaning. And you look at, you know, you look at people who continue to have that, women foremost, but, you know, things like pride parades, like Black History Month, whatever, where we're celebrating certain communities. And I think it feels, if you have a warped view of the universe for whatever reason, I think it feels like they're the enemy instead of, you know, the five people who control however much of the world's wealth it is.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to get into my issues with the
I'm sorry?
You want to give my issues with the writer's strike? With the writer's thing?
I think writer's strike?
No. I mean, I'll get in trouble. But I think there are parallels.
Okay.
I
will say as someone who – I guess I am a WGA member now. But I will say as someone who is vaguely on the edges of this, I think you're right. I think there are parallels. I think that there are – I do think that the problem is the whole system is very hard to topple. So you look at the things you can directly look mm-hmm. at and try and topple those. And maybe you make small changes around the edges, but the system warps itself and is poisonous. And like, there needs to be some sort of systemic change or we're going to cease to exist as a species. And like,
yeah,
there you go. Anyway, that's what the Matrix is about.
The Matrix feels, yeah. I mean, I hear everything you're saying. I don't know that I necessarily totally agree with all of it, but I
you don't agree that the Matrix is about the WGA ATA standoff? Because it is. It prophesied it.
So I want to sort of, you know, you obviously brought up.
Well, I actually want to kind of pull this back because what is the Matrix ultimately about? It's about seeding control, right? Mm-hmm. It's not everything it's about, but it's about seeding control. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Have either of you listened to Live or Die in LA, the podcast?
No.
No.
That's fucking awesome. Do you know about it?
No.
Mm-mm. All right. There's not much to it, but you should listen to it. It's basically, it's a true crime podcast. It's tremendous.
Okay.
It's like something that's happening right now. But basically it's Neil Strauss who wrote the game. So like, you know, take it with a grain of salt. I'm telling you, he's great. He runs through this site called, you know, takeout.google.com is?
No.
Mm-hmm. You do
I've
know.
Heard of it. I've heard of it.
If you go to takeout.google.com, you could find out all the information about you that Google is tracking.
Okay.
So you could find out all of your emails, all of your YouTube history, all, you know, every app you used, your search history, it goes on and on and on, and kind of most alarmingly, your location history.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere you've been, Google is aware of this.
Okay.
We have ceded so much control over our lives to Google, Apple, Facebook, Snapchat, et cetera, et cetera. I only bring those four up because those are the four he brought up, not that anyone uses Snapchat. But to those four, that it's not that big of a leap to think that if and when AI becomes sentient,
oh, yeah,
with all of this information, they, all this control we've given over to them willingly, they will be able to use it against us very easily.
Oh, yeah.
So we're not even that far from the reality of the Matrix if – now I'm getting into AI like fucking – like AI truth or shit. But like we're not that far from this whole thing. Like if AI proves to be malevolent, we're in deep fucking trouble.
It doesn't even have to be malevolent. Like the famous thought experiment is there's an AI that makes paperclips, and like you say all you need to do is make as many paperclips as possible. And then it's like, well, if I disassemble these molecules, I can make more paperclips, and it eventually fills the entire universe with paperclips. Right. And that's not like – that motivation isn't malevolent. It's just like really foreign to us.
Right. It's made me feel a little bit better about – I'm getting into some real fucking horrible shit. Made me feel a little bit better about life on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Only because I actually truly believe that there are levels of, knowledge and understanding about the world and universe that we will never come close to understanding. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, our next step is not as scary to me as it previously was. But yes, I'm very concerned about the Matrix actually becoming kind of real in one form or another.
I think it's inevitable. And I think a lot of us are going to move into it willingly. Like,
totally.
You ask me if I could live in a space where I would appear to be a cis woman. I'd think about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think cis woman version of me is terrible. She's probably like votes Republican.
I don't know if I want that.
So like, I'm glad that I am who I am, but also yeah. Like if I could like live in a computer program and I don't know, look like Reese Witherspoon. Yeah. Hell yeah. I'd do it.
You'd pull Joey Pants.
Yeah.
That's the most honest moment of that movie.
Yeah. Cypher.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. Yeah. I mean, I mean, hell, the Wachowskis themselves just said they would have taken the blue pill.
Taking the blue pill is different than doing what Joey Pants. No,
I know,
Pants
but
does.
I'm just saying.
I would not. I don't know if I would have taken
it. The ignorance is bliss idea. I think there is something to that. Mm-hmm. With that in mind, Kanye West.
I was not expecting that.
Has called The Matrix the Bible of the post-information age and said that when hundreds of guys come at Neo, those are opinions. That's perception. That's tradition. If you focus wide and master sense is like Lawrence Fishburne and you have a squad behind you, you literally put the world in slow motion. Also, he claims to be writing a philosophy book called Break the Simulation. He has got the Kardashians to wear tiny sunglasses, and sweatshirts and bomber jackets from Yeezy Season 1 look a lot like things from the Nebuchadnezzar. So he's definitely jacked into the Matrix.
These rich tech utopian guys, and Kanye West is kind of in that. Like they all are like, oh, we're living in a simulation because they hate to acknowledge the role they play.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Elon Musk is huge. Yeah. I mean, he's put –
because if they live in a simulation, then it's kind of a form of fundamentalist Christianity.
It sort of is. If
you live in a simulation, you can give yourself like an excuse to be like, oh, I don't have any control over my actions. I have to keep exploiting.
It's Calvinism, yeah.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
That all being said.
Yeah.
Prove him wrong.
I mean.
The thing about it is if we live in a simulation, it has no real effect on our philosophical moral
totally
judgments to each other. You know, like we still have an obligation to be good to each other, yeah. Even if we live in a fake world.
100%. But there's a little bit of a get it a jail free card of it though.
Sure.
You no, there's not mean? Because we'll never know. So,
well, I mean, in the sense that like if you're a person who believes everything is a simulation, it gives you the ability to be able to do things that you wouldn't necessarily do.
I don't agree with that.
I think Elon Musk agrees with that.
Elon Musk still goes to jail if he does something bad. So
does he?
that's the question.
That's a fair point. But yeah, actually, that's a fair point.
probably if he murdered a whole bunch. If he was a serial killer, probably he'd go to jail. But that's like as far as I'm willing
yeah.
to go.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of this also taps into the Wachowskis made everyone read Smok.
how do you say it?
Simulacrum, I believe.
Yes, simulacrum. And simulation. All the required reading of all the sort of these various texts of all of that, which and Keanu also read Out of Control and Evolutionary Psychology and all of these philosophical ideas, which are coursing through this film, which again is another reason why I get kind of annoyed with Ebert's review, mm-hmm. because he's either not open to it or he's dismissive of it or he thinks it's just a fucking action movie when there's so much intelligence and thought and brain power put into this movie to make sure that it's not just a fucking action movie. I don't know.
But it is kind of just an action movie too. It's both.
Isn't that Aronofsky's point, right? That it works on whatever level. Yeah.
But Josh is like, whatever you bring to it.
But Josh's point. I think that engaging with the ideas in this, and we're doing it right now. Yeah. Like, I mean, I don't know if anyone's familiar with the term SUDS. Subjective units of distress. SUDS are high. Basically, like my SUDS are rising.
Yeah.
As I have this conversation, because engaging with these ideas mm-hmm. is distressful for me,
mm-hmm.
or distressing for me. And I think that a lot of people don't even want to have these conversations that we're having right now. I mean, I do. I love having them.
Sure.
But as a way of processing. What I think this world is coming to. So I'm terrified of climate change
mm-hmm.
and I'm, you know, terrified of, you know, the disenfranchisement of people and people being made – people essentially losing their personhood. Like I'm terrified of these terrestrial things that are happening to people.
Sure.
But I also am very scared of what's happening 50 years from now, you know, or where we're going with technology in this world.
Yeah.
So.
I think that's why Cloud Atlas is my favorite Wachowski movie. And I think that's why I love that movie so much is it does like go – it goes to a really grim place. But mm-hmm. then there is this element of like, oh, and everything turns out okay. And like I love its ideas of eternal recurrence and all of that.
Do you like the book more than the movie?
Probably. I think they're very different mm-hmm. and I love them both. But yeah, I don't know. I think –
I mean, I think that it, on the Cloud Atlas of it all, there is a part of me that feels like, I mean, that's them taking perhaps their biggest swing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Just it's about.
It's the one movie they had to get like independent funding for. Yeah.
And also, I mean, sort of co-directed with Tom Tykwer and mm-hmm. all of that. But mm-hmm. it is the enormity of what they're trying to say. In that film,
it's like Terrence Malick in a way, just this like long view thing. Yeah. And you know, I love that. But what was the Terrence Malick
movie? Tree of Life?
Yes. Yeah. The idea of like, this is the only one we got. This is heaven. This is hell.
Here's a dinosaur.
Yeah. Here's everything. A lot of whispering. Here's everything we've ever given you. I got to tell you one thing real fast about dinosaurs. My daughter, you're not going to believe this.
Yeah.
She's a dinosaur truther. She doesn't believe, 7 years old, doesn't believe dinosaurs existed on Earth. I took her to the museum to show her dinosaur bones. She's like, why couldn't they have just put them here? How do you know they didn't just make them? And then we went to the La Brea tar pits to look at like old animal things.
Sure.
And they had like this woolly mammoth tooth.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm like, Layla, you're touching a woolly mammoth tooth. Like, it's obviously real. And the person holding it goes, well, actually, this is a replica. And she looks at me and she's like,
fucking told you.
Yeah. She's like, what now, pops? And there's nothing I can say.
Yeah, you can't fight that.
Well, I mean,
that guy threw you under the bus.
I can't prove that dinosaurs really existed any more than I've tried. I'm like, what about the oil in your car, you little dummies?
That's what the Matrix is about.
There you go.
That's what the Matrix is about. Actually, my best friend growing up, he lives out here. He's a paleontologist. I'll hook you up.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. He can
explain it. Yeah.
Yeah.
He'll come on the show to talk about the out-of-towners, but in the process.
I wonder if we have a dinosaur movie?
I don't think we have a dinosaur movie.
How could we not? I'll look.
So let's talk a little casting.
Do we have a dinosaur movie? Yeah. Dinosaur movie every year.
Yeah.
The big one that we all know is the Will Smith of it all. Was approached to play it, turned it down to do Wild Wild West. Obviously the better decision.
No more Mr. Knife Guy.
Wouldn't have had that without him. I don't know what this movie looks like with Will Smith. I don't.
Makes this look good.
Oh, jeez. I like Will Smith a lot. But there is something about Keanu's sort of zen-like qualities that he has that just makes it all really come to life. I also have to say, too, and there was an interesting piece that I read about how this movie changed the perception of the action hero. Mm-hmm. You know, Keanu's a pretty slight guy. I mean, he's tall, but he's not a muscle build, you know, muscly action hero. And he kind of opened the door for that to be a lane that people could go down, mm-hmm. which I think is also interesting.
He's coded white. He himself is not white.
He's
mixed
race. He's mixed race, yeah.
And like
– Which works for the movie.
It takes a long time for Hollywood to kind of glom onto that. But he and Will Smith kind of like start trending the industry in that direction, which is kind of goes back to the red pill thing we were talking about. But like
– Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and I think that is another way that this changes.
It's also – so apparently Lana and Lily's first choice for Neo is Johnny Depp.
Which makes sense.
The Johnny Depp Keanu thing, I sort of get it. You know what I mean? I think that it's clear that they wanted someone slightly androgynous, I guess, to a certain degree. That it was clear that they didn't want an alpha male as this action hero, which is why you see them sort of push back. I mean, I guess Brad Pitt was brought up, Val Kilmer was brought up. You know, these are all, you know, Ewan McGregor, David Duchovny, Leonardo DiCaprio.
I think that I really with the possible exception of Will Smith.
Yeah.
I think this movie would have worked with any of those guys.
Yeah, they're perhaps prettier.
Yes.
Then they are hard. You know.
One of the interesting Gillian Anderson turned down the role of Trinity. Apparently,
do it with Gillian Anderson and David Duchovny. Great. Great.
Before the X-Files happened, they were both approached.
That's Mitch Pileggi can be
Morpheus?
Yeah.
That's like out of a really bad movie. They like went to see David Duchovny to like for the movie. They're like, wait a sec, what about her for Trinity?
It's so ridiculous. Gary Oldman and Sam Jackson were both approached for Morpheus.
Oh, man.
Which, I mean, again, these are all like
– these would have worked.
These would have worked. And again, testament to how great this movie is, that you really could have kind of put a lot of these people into these roles and it would have worked.
I've never thought of Sam Jackson as the poor man's Lawrence Fishburne. But that's what he is.
In this situation,
What he's to me in life. Yeah. I love Sam Jackson. I've been standing here saying, he should, like, how does this guy not win an Oscar? And he has to win an Oscar before he dies. But I don't know if he's ever done what Lawrence Fishburne did in this movie.
I mean, Lawrence Fishburne was born to play Morpheus.
Oh my God.
And it's just, I mean, I don't know. I also have to say too, like, he's like some of these people that, I mean, Gary Oldman is an example of like, I want someone that he could fight someone, you know, people have talked about how Sean Connery apparently was in the mix for Morpheus, whether or not that's true or not feels like some sort of an urban legend in its own way. But like, I don't know. These people all just feel like it had to be Lawrence Fishburne. I don't know. I mean, for what that's worth. The actress Belinda McClory, who plays the role of Switch, mm-hmm. the character was originally planned to be played by androgynous actors. In the real world, it would be played by a male actor. In Zion, it would be played by a female.
I wonder what that's all about.
But then Warner Brothers was like, I don't know about that. And yeah,
Warner Brothers was like, well, I don't think people will understand that.
Right. The confusion was where that came from.
Yeah.
But it is one of those sort of it's one of those films where people have talked about, you know, recently even the Sandra Bullock thing came up where they were like, fuck it, we'll turn Neo, we'll flip it and we'll make it. Mm-hmm. And she turned that down. She turned down the role of Trinity as well. I guess Keanu brought her up because of Speed and what have you. I think she could have been an interesting Trinity. You know, I think I don't.
Carrie Ann Moss is also
great,
made for this role too. It's just like they're just perfect. Every member of the ship, every member of this cast, it's just perfect.
It's really perfect. And I would actually say that one of the things that disappointed me about the sequels was the unfortunate passing of the actress who played the Oracle, because
mm-hmm.
that's one of my favorite scenes in this whole movie. In the first Matrix,
she's great and Reloaded too.
Yes.
Yeah. But then I mean, the other person's great in Revolutions, but
it's
so different.
It's so different.
They could have,
played that a little more. I know that's it's kind of a gross thing to say you could play a person's real life death a little more, but given the nature of the world, they kind of got like the closest approximation to this person.
Yeah, they could have done something very different.
They could have gone crazy with it.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Especially if like the specific in-world reason was she was trying to evade capture.
Which, you know, it's sort of like I remember when at the end of – and this is sort of a strange allusion, but I'll do it anyway. At the end of Fantastic Beasts, when Johnny Depp shows up because he was pretending to be
Colin Farrell
the whole time. And then when all this stuff went down between, you know, the first and the second movie, I was like, he's a shapeshifter, guys. Doesn't need to be Johnny Depp anymore. Yeah. If, you know, just make it somebody else. But to that point, like, there was this opportunity here for it to be a drastically dissimilar actor, and they didn't choose to do it.
I think you do kind of, like, this plays into the stereotype of the magical Negro, but you kind of do need it to be an older black lady once you've committed to that, you know?
That might be true.
You could maybe go younger black lady, but like I think you kind of need to do that both in terms of like the Wachowskis' mission of diverse casting.
But there's other minorities that
sure, and like others that wouldn't play into the stereotype as much. But at the same time, you know, you run into that when someone leaves a role who's a person of color, and like that is a representation of a very specific sort that you don't get elsewhere. Erasure. You know?
Yeah. No, that's interesting.
I thought about that and I hear that, but that feels tokenism. That feels like tokenism.
I think so. Me. I agree. I think as a white lady, it's hard for me to speak about like what something like that means to someone who doesn't see themselves on screen a lot. And if they're suddenly replaced with like Reba McEntire or something, you know,
that would have been
a poor choice. That would have been poor casting.
That would have been bad. and I agree with that, but I do wonder which is more cynical. You know?
Yeah.
I think it's all cynical at a certain point. Like, and that's the thing is when a role like this has to be recast, there is a cynicism to no matter what you do, you know?
Sure.
Even if you're like, I'm just going to pick the best actor for this role. Like, it's an unfortunate circumstance that leads to like rushed decision-making.
Yeah.
I mean, they had two deaths. They had Aaliyah also passing away during Unreloaded. She was playing –
was she the Jada Pinkett Smith part?
No. She was the wife of what's his face? Whose name? I can't remember. Walt's dad from Lost.
Harold
Perrineau.
Yeah.
Were they talking about Jada Pinkett for
– Trinity. She auditioned and she said she didn't have any chemistry or didn't have as much chemistry with Keanu.
Yeah.
She could have done it.
She could have done it.
I think she could have been a good Trinity.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's all just really.
I would have liked to have seen that. I like her in those kind of roles.
She was, I mean, I wish that they did more with her as Niobe. She didn't really get to do a ton in the next two.
She's like in the video game a lot, I guess.
Yes, she is. Like, I had that game, Enter the Matrix. I remember that. And I was like, this is great. And yeah, she just doesn't. She's in. Isn't there some connection to her in the Animatrix? Maybe I'm crazy.
Yeah.
I think that role might be in there too.
I think so.
I haven't seen the Animatrix in a very long time. I should watch them.
Yeah, I remember I watched them once when they came out.
Yeah.
I
should watch them again.
But they were cool.
They were cool. I mean, again, like that's such a cool thing that they did that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Again, way ahead of the curve on that. I mean, I think that you could maybe get away with that today, maybe digital shorts or something along those lines, depending on what the universe is. We're essentially doing it with a lot of these TV shows that are sort of ancillary to movies, but still it's fascinating. I do love this. It's such a little thing, but the Oracle giving Neo a literal and a figurative cookie, I think is great.
Mm-hmm.
I just love nerdy shit like that. I just think it's kind of great. It's like David Sims and the whole like login screen.
Seraph is a login screen.
I just love it.
When I was watching Reloaded,
yeah.
I was watching Revolutions. Like I DM'd him and was like, "You got to tell me who these people that live in like the subway station, who they are." And he like just like this screen
diatribe.
Yeah, just like it just
oh my God.
Flooded down, and like he screenshotted part of it and put it on Twitter. Is like always here to talk about the Matrix.
What did he say?
God, I'm sure I can find it.
That's really funny.
Let me dig it up here.
So I want to talk just a little bit about the photography. I think it is a travesty that this film was not nominated for Best Cinematography. I think it's
insane. Let's see what it was.
Robert Richardson for Snow Falling on Cedars. It was
he's doing this from memory.
Yeah, because I looked it up earlier.
Got
today.
All one of them. So
I
got
Conrad one, Hall for American.
Yeah, he won. Yeah. There was also Roger Platt for End of the Affair, which is the one that I probably would have lifted. And the other two, I can't remember off the top of my head.
The other two, oh, Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah. Manuel Lubezki. Yeah.
And The Insider, Dante.
Also Spinotti. I mean, those – I personally, I mean, I haven't seen Snow Falling on Cedars in a very long time. I remember being really pretty.
We'll be doing it very soon.
We will be doing it very soon. And I think that End of the Affair is a very nice-looking movie, but Bill Pope changed cinematography forever with this film. Mm-hmm. And I think that's crazy that this film wasn't acknowledged for it. It's also – this movie went 4 for 4 with the Oscars it was nominated for. Wow. So
this movie, I mean, in this era, this would have been a Best Picture nominee.
Yes.
It would have been nominated for 7 or 8. Probably wouldn't have gotten director. Probably couldn't have won Best Picture, but definitely would have been –
a contender, a serious contender.
So I asked this. This is I asked David if all these characters are computer programs. Who's the damn Train Man supposed to be? He says in all caps, "I can answer all questions." Train Man is basically a sophisticated Dropbox plus the dark web moves things around for you without anyone noticing. And I said, "Oh my god, this is amazing! Thank you." And he says, "Ask me more questions." And then there's like several screens
that's
of us
incredible.
Talking
oh,
about the Matrix
great.
Sequels.
Yeah. That's really funny.
I'm watch wow. Reloaded tonight.
Yeah, you should. It's. I mean,
well, so, no, I will. Okay. I really will. It's. I. This is so embarrassing, but like, it didn't even occur to me to watch it after I like after
oh,
I
really?
I texted you after Wake Up or after you know the end of the Matrix and had that same feeling that I've had every time I watch this movie, which is like coolest
it's over
movie
now.
Ever made. But like, there's nothing else here. This is a standalone movie.
Really?
I have memory wiped those movies.
I think you would really like them.
They might as well be Jaws 2 and Jaws 3D to me.
Here's what happened to the Reloaded, tying into our earlier discussion about Ain't It Cool and white guys and all that. Reloaded is a movie about telling white guys they're not the chosen one. And people got really mad about that. And Revolutions is an attempt to synthesize, yes, you can be the chosen one. There is no chosen one. And tell a story about how like communities can be the chosen one in essence. And like finding a way to synthesize whatever. It's disappointing, Revolutions, but I really love everything Reloaded does philosophically, and like your brain's going to blow up.
I would also
I will
say
watch it.
I
report back.
I do think you will like them. I think it's also an opportunity, one of the few it feels like to me where they did sort of two things. They learned from the quote unquote mistakes that they might have made in the first one, or at least the things that they that set people some people off, or choices that were made. And they wanted to balance the scales again, right? So they went in a direction that they felt, to what you were saying, could help that. But then in the process, they alienated people in a completely different way by doing sequels that was not what people had wanted from these sequels.
And I'll admit the first hour of that movie's a little slow. I think the action Rave. Sequences – I think the action sequences have really held up. Even the Burly Brawl, which the effects there are a little shaky, but just like the choreography of it's gorgeous – I think the freeway chase is
it's
one
unreal.
Of the great action sequences of all time.
I'm looking forward to
fully
watching
agree
that.
With that.
That in my head, I'm thinking, well, at least I get that.
Yeah.
You also
if
get
it sucks, at least I get that.
The foyer fight, which one
is
of the
great.
Best fights as well. It's
I think it's that great. The architect scene, for as much as people hate it, I think it's audacious. I love everything that happens in that scene. I love the idea that like it's a story about how, again, capitalism just sets up systems that are doomed to propagate themselves. That revolution against capitalism is ultimately exploited by capitalism and like subverted and turned into a part of capitalism. And we have pride flags on Budweiser cans. And like, that's the story of that movie. Matrix Reloaded, coming to podcasts like it's 2003.
Yeah. Well, Revolutions is also 2003,
yes,
isn't
it? Yes, it is. Yeah.
I mean, I will also say that the cliffhanger is disappointing. I remember sitting in the theater and being like, okay.
Well, the cliffhanger was with in Zion.
Yeah.
When he kind of stopped.
It's when we realized that Smith
has infiltrated the real world and then they never really do anything with
it. They don't do anything with it.
Sucks,
no.
Yeah. But the bigger
they kill him.
It also makes no sense.
The thing that blew my mind that really got me was that architect scene where he's like, "Oh yeah, you're not actually there's been 6 of you. We use you to reset the system." Like
it's great.
Well,
it's crazy.
That's what got me really actually I remember leaving Reloaded and being very excited because of the architect scene and thinking what they could do in Revolutions because of this is endless.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember being wildly disappointed by Revolutions and you know, retroactively hating Reloaded too because what they set up and never paid off.
That's
the last 45 minutes of Revolutions is great, and everything leading up to it is really hit and miss. I think it's their weakest movie, but also there's so much really good stuff in it. I think where it ends is very poetic and interesting.
I'm very excited to watch. All I remember is like the sunset, but I'm definitely gonna watch
I'm gonna be very I'm very curious to hear what you think.
There was someone. The thing is, like, it was I'd built them up so much. The Matrix was so important to me.
Yeah.
And I did this with Fight Club 2 in the theater. I didn't like Fight Club when I saw it in the theater because 7 was – and the game were so important to me.
Sure.
That it was a bar that movie could never cross. Also happened with Crouching Tiger, by the way. Where like Ang Lee stuff up to that moment was so important to me that it was a bar I could never cross. But I subsequently love Fight Club and Crouching Tiger.
Are you like a big Ride with the Devil super fan? Do you have like – a t-shirt, Ride with the Devil.
I've never seen Ride with the Devil.
It's really the Ice Storm.
Oh, Ice Storm's great.
I just think it's the greatest fucking movie. And yeah.
I wish it was 99.
We'll do it anyway.
Yeah. Speaking of the photography, which I think is interesting, obviously, but the bullet time stuff, there is a moment. The bullet time moment is described in the script as such. It says, Jones's gun booms as we enter the liquid space of bullet time. The air sizzles with wads of lead like angry flies as Neo twists, bends, ducks just beneath them. Neo bent impossibly back, one hand on the ground as a spiraling gray ball shears open his shoulder. That single shot took over 2 years to complete and took $750,000 in computer costs to do. But it's
bargain.
It is. But it's just – I remember watching it and just thinking like this is unbelievable. Like it and you know, they do it a couple times because, you know.
Wasn't that moment in some of the marketing? Because I feel like I'd seen it before I went
to the – Yes, it was in the trailer. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
That was the only bullet time sequence they showed in the trailer, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm pretty sure it was the cherry at the end of the trailer, if I'm not mistaken.
What is the other thing called? The thing where they go 180?
Isn't that what we're talking about, the same thing?
I mean, it's a different technique. I don't remember the
name. Bullet time.
Bullet time is the ripples of the bullets and doing the turn.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Those are two distinctly different things to me.
Okay.
The thing, the 180 thing, there are two pioneering things that they did in this movie. It was the bullet time and it was that 180 thing that they started doing every fucking commercial. And then like literally the NFL took it and like put it on, you know, the Super Bowl. And I love that. I love that so much because I love how analog it is.
Yeah.
You know, it speaks to my heart how you could have done that same exact thing in 1940 if you wanted to.
You know? Think so?
The 180 thing? Yeah. Set up 100 cameras. And you're not even putting video cameras.
Yeah, no, I love it.
You could have done that at any point in like basically film history.
Yeah.
So I love like that, like the post-it kind of thing of it. You know, anyone could have figured this out. They just figured it out. But that doesn't have a name?
I don't know what it is.
I'm Googling matrix rotation and it turns out it's a thing you can do with a mathematical matrix, which I never would have known. So it's impossible to find because people are talking about math, which is dumb. Jesus. Why are you doing that?
Why would anybody want to do that? It's just boring. So – I think that it's I can't seem to find what it. Do you have you been able to find it, Kenny?
What's that? What's it called?
The thing.
I'm looking for it.
Okay. So yeah,
it's gonna be hard.
Yeah. We're talking about math now. So one of the other things that I think is interesting is that in the first 45 minutes of the film, Neo has 80 lines.
Hmm.
44 of those lines are questions. Just over half of his total dialogue, averaging roughly one question per minute. I mean, he's obviously, you know, a bit of an exposition. He's our audience. Mm-hmm. He's our way in. So I get that. But it's also a surprisingly silent character for a good chunk of that movie. It feels like it opens with a lot of him being very kind of introverted for obvious reasons. And then he sort of comes into his own. And to come back to sort of the Oracle scene, the reason that I love it so much is it feels like you really kind of fall for Neo in that scene.
Yeah.
He just feels like a real person who's surprisingly disappointed that he's not the one who really bought into all of it. It's at the perfect point of the movie where you know, it can slow down for a second and it can be a real character piece. Yeah. It can be a really beautiful scene between two people.
And the waiting room stuff's great too.
The waiting rooms, all that stuff. Like it's so interesting how the movie really, I mean, this is an editing thing, but this is also a screenwriting thing, but just that the ebbs and flows of the film are really kind of perfect. It knows when it needs to jack things up and it knows when it can take a second and be really, I mean, it's incredible stuff.
That whole Oracle – and the Oracle thing is seeded into the story so well too, because that's where Morpheus gets taken. So like you have – that's a great screenwriting thing of like you know you have this tension hanging over it. But also like that scene for me is what takes it from great movie to masterpiece, like that whole sequence. And I don't think either of the sequels has a sequence quite like that. And I think that's what holds them back a little bit. I like – again, to talk about Black Panther, I think that is the function these scenes in the afterlife serve in that movie where he goes and communes with his ancestors or whatever. Like you need that thing that's like a moment where the hero kind of clarifies the stakes and who they are and all of that. And a lot of these modern action movies that gets noted out or something, you know?
It's no, I totally agree with that.
I also love the scene for all the reasons you guys are saying, but I also, there's something that it does that you never see in movies. I remember seeing this with my parents and feeling kind of alienated on their behalf from what was happening on screen. And to slow it down and take you to essentially a grandma's kitchen was a scene where I felt like we could all get on board with this scene together. You know, we could all calm down together. You're definitely not going to be afraid of this scene. You're definitely not going to feel confused in this scene. Even though some of those most important things that are happening in the movie are happening right now, you definitely can come with me now. And I think that really, that kind of stuff That's really awesome. Helped them. And really even helped me, you know, feeling like, oh, so yeah, there is all this like kind of techno babble stuff going on that I can work with a little bit, but you still do care about me and making me feel comfortable as you're taking me through this world. I think it's such a masterstroke.
I totally agree.
Every second of it. I think about it all the time.
Yeah, it's really, really beautiful stuff. So before we get into the plot, this feels like a good place to end part one.
Yeah.
There are four people in this room. One of them isn't real, and you're going to find out next week which one.
It's a great cliffhanger. It's better than the Reloaded cliffhanger.
Oh, yeah.
Zing. All right. Next week, we'll continue this
part two.
And please tune in. Thanks.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.